This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
It's the evening edition with Kelvin and Ayman. We're spending this week looking back at some of the biggest events of the year, this time with a focus on international headlines. Joining us to do that is Amir Farid Rahim, Director of Strategy at KRRA Group.
And you can join the conversation. WhatsApp at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Amir, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me here.
So let's start with the general outlook of international news this year, right? So what has been your view of what happened around the world this year? What has been a development which stood out the most and had the biggest impact on the international community?
Well, I mean, to me, 2009 was a continuation of what has been going on the past few years, or specifically over the past decade. This is the end of that. We are already at the end of the decade here. People everywhere in the world are becoming angrier. Lots of protests everywhere over different kind of issues, from environment to socio-economic issues, loss of jobs, political protests against sitting regimes, stuff like that. So people generally are getting angrier. And the root cause of this, if we can see... I would like to see it from a decade point of view. Yeah, is the aftermath or the failure to manage the after effects of globalization, and the root cause to this, as we all can generally agree, is that of the major cause is that of inequality, and this has given then rise to. Populism, nationalism. In probably the first half of the decade, we saw the potential of socialism, a wave of socialism coming in with Bernie Sanders in the US and that sort of rhetoric. But as the decade picked up through the second half of the decade, nationalism, Trump brand of populism took over in different forms in different countries around the globe. Back to 2019, I could not pinpoint one event
that stood out.
That stood out in that context. But it was more of the same trends being reinforced and seen in different scale and geographies.
So. Before we go way abroad, let's perhaps look at how we fared locally as an international player. So Malaysia introduced its new foreign policy framework this year. What were your thoughts on it when it was launched? And will it provide a platform for Malaysia to enhance its role in international affairs?
Well, yes, it was when it was announced by the foreign minister and the prime minister and the foreign minister earlier this year, with the theme change in continuity, there was a lot of expectation on how Malaysia could redefine itself on the global stage, given that in the past 3 years, when the 1MDB scandal hit the Malaysian government, there was a sense of retreat on the international stage, and there was a sense that our credibility was being greatly questioned internationally, and therefore Malaysia could not play that role that it used to as a small nation, middle power, which punches above its weight. And there is still that great hope that under Dr. Mahathir Mohamad's second coming as Prime Minister, that we would continue to pursue such a foreign policy. What more in light of the current battle between the superpowers, especially in terms of sphere of influence? We have the US in the West, China in the East, and not to forget, sometimes I've been in certain forums across across the globe, and people forget about Russia in certain parts of the world. And of course, Russia is a big issue in the US, but because Russian voices are not as strong as the Chinese ones in the past few years, doesn't mean that it is not an important player still. And how do Malaysia now manage its relationship with all these different superpowers is something that we would want to see more closely under this change in continuity. How do you maintain previously, and the previous regime was equidistant between US and China, for instance. But under this change in continuity, although it's its continuity, but there is already stark policy contrast from the previous government, in which, for instance, when the Prime Minister, Dr. Mahathir, announced that we should side with Huawei in the US-China trade war in terms of technology, for instance, that was clearly taking one side. Yeah? And interestingly also, Malaysia tries to play its role again in the Muslim world, where it was the same theatre that Dr. Mahathir played on when he was Prime Minister in the first round, but more effectively using OIC. But given what has happened in the Middle East with Saudi, UAE and the US alliance boycotting Qatar, for example, that has caused great shifts in the political geopolitical dynamics in the Middle East. There is a clear US Saudi alliance versus those who are not supporting, and those who are attending this KL summit, for instance, are clearly from the other camp. How do then we Malaysia play that balancing role to moderate the discussion on the global Ummah more effectively as a global player to make sure that the agenda advances further?
So just to look at some of our Southeast Asian neighbours, right? A number of countries in Southeast Asia has had their general elections, and starting with Indonesia, they had their presidential election this year. What were Indonesians' biggest concerns policy-wise leading up to the elections?
Well, in Indonesia, of course, not unlike many other countries around the region, economic issues were top consideration. Cost of living, cost of fuel, for instance, was a major issue. Job opportunities for the young, as we can see, millennials were very vocal in this round of elections, and they were questioning now the track record of President Jokowi, who was seeking a re-election. Of course, in the first term, President Jokowi was the darling of the millennials and most of social media. But given his mixed track record in his first term, some of these issues were raised, and the millennials especially were very vocal against some of the achievements, or lack of achievements by President Jokowi. But he still won handsomely, and that is contributed to his great political strategy of harnessing the Islamic votes and getting into the heart of the Java versus non-Java politics. He won big in the Java Islands, and the political strategy is by choosing a number two who is from the ulama background and who is from Java itself. So it paid off. And now with a bigger mandate, he's got a very big responsibility to cement a greater legacy. You've got to remember that President Jokowi was an outsider coming into Indonesian elite politics, and therefore that made him relatable. He is an out-of-towner, a folksy gentleman that Indonesians fell in love with, and therefore the expectations for him to succeed is also great. And it is hopefully in his second term he will focus on the right issues, especially education and provision of healthcare for the rest of the population. And as we can see in his new cabinet lineup, he has picked very charismatic characters to be in the cabinet. And for example, the education minister, Nadiem Makarim, he is the CEO of, he was the CEO of Gojek, the biggest unicorn in Indonesian startup landscape and leader in technology. He has the right credentials as well as the right attitude towards fixing the education system. And his first couple of speeches and public appearances since becoming education minister have been very well received by the general public. And he is hitting right at the issue, for instance, on the issue of quality of teachers in ensuring better improvement and reform in the education system. And that has hit the right note among the general Indonesian public.
You know, we'll continue this discussion on Indonesia right after this. We are speaking today to Ame Farid, Director of Strategy at KRA Group, helping us wrap up the international events of 2019. You are listening to the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
It's the Evening Edition with Kelvin and Ayman, and we are continuing our conversation with Ame Farid Rahim, Director of Strategy at KRA Group, about the international events and the headlines of 2019 as part of our year-end wrap-up. Now, we're going to continue our conversation about Indonesia. Earlier, we left off talking about Jokowi and as well as Indonesia's education minister. Now, interestingly, Jokowi also chose Prabowo Subianto to be his defense minister. What's the rationale behind that, and will it strengthen his administration?
I think the main rationale behind appointing Prabowo is to show a strong signal that Jokowi is the bigger person in Indonesian politics, one. And two, is also to appease... Prabowo has run as presidential candidate twice against Jokowi and once as a vice presidential candidate earlier. And he is one with, of course, a very checkered human rights background. But in terms of credentials in defense and understanding what needs to be done in terms of reforming the military, he is the right pick. And of course, I think the consideration also for Jokowi is better to have keep your friends close, but your enemies closer to you in this respect. And this also shows confidence, I think, on Jokowi's side that at the end of the day, he is still the boss, and Defense Minister Prabowo will still have to report to the president.
Another country that had their elections this year was Thailand. This is the first time they had a general election since the 2014 military coup. And there was a lot of drama regarding the candidates. This is the Thai Raksachat's Princess Uborana and future forwards Tharathon Juangrun Wongkit, and which may ultimately lead to the dissolution of both of these parties. So what can we make of all of this, like, in terms of like democratization and all that?
Well, there's little that we can make of democratization. It was a much not unexpected results and outcome. Of course, there were hopes that the result, it would have been a fairer election. But as we can see with the disqualification of certain candidates and later on with the future party MP Tharathon being blocked as a MP and now faces deregistration of the whole party. It shows that, you know, the interesting thing in Thailand is the politics and the economy goes different ways. It is not as intertwined as in certain countries. Politics can go one way, economy can go the other. And the economy for many years of the past decade, since 1990, there's been at least 20 coups, political change in Thailand. Some are most backed by the establishment. Establishment, we talk about the royals and the existing generals, the elites. But the economy continues to grow, and therefore, I think the same is happening now, but of course the change is previously it was King Bhumibol, which was much revered, much loved mm-hmm. by the country, the rest of the nation. Now you have a new king who is still, a lot of people are still figuring him out mm-hmm. after all these years.
Well, and on that note, right, what interestingly happened was also the Thai king's move to fire some palace officials and strip his consort of her titles. What can we read from that situation?
It's not untypical of the king's behavior to do something of this nature. It goes to show that there is a stronger move towards absolute power and absolute control of the monarchy here, and one day you can be and how mercurial or unpredictable his temperament can be. One day you can be in favor and the next day you are not. But also the paranoia, if you talk to people in Thailand among journalists and all that, if there is a sense that there is great paranoia in the elite system, how long can this particular system hold up given the massive protest that we've also seen in Thailand over the past decade, and now what more with the protests that, as we said, the whole global citizen is getting angrier. This is just the right ingredients for another uprise in Thailand. But of course, everyone is giving the king the benefit of the doubt to show how he would play his role in the body politics of Thailand.
And talking about another key figure in this region, Myanmar leader Aung San Suu Kyi has gone to trial at the International Court of Justice over accusations of genocide. How significant will this case be, and where do you see it developing moving forward?
Well, this issue over which the Myanmar government has got to defend itself in the ICJ is, of course, very interesting one, because it's two different narratives. You have, of course, the Myanmar government completely saying that it's all untrue. Whereas the Gambian believe that the government should be held responsible. So it is interesting how the ICJ, this is the third time that the ICJ is facing such cases when it comes to trial of genocide. And one thing that is difficult with getting to a verdict when it comes to trial of genocide is proving intent. And this is where I think the same will be with this case. And internationally, Aung San Suu Kyi's profile will take a hit. She is seen as, you know, the freedom fighter, Lady Liberty, and, you know, goddess-like status. But with having to defend the country on this issue in the ICJ, it will, to an extent, I think, bring the glitter off that shine from Aung San Suu Kyi. But having said that, she is still widely popular in Myanmar. There is no, however, I've been asking friends in Yangon, Nyapidau, is there like sort of approval ratings on to measure Aung San Suu Kyi? There's just that there isn't. No one is polling, mm-hmm. So there is a market there. But what is interesting is the rallies that have been held in her support,
right,
has been huge. So she is still broadly very popular domestically, but of course, international standing will take a hit. Of course, Myanmar's standing on in the international front is always, especially with its track records with regards to treatment of Muslims, have always been in question. Even Malaysia has raised the issue with regards to Rakhine State in different forums in ASEAN. But will there be more international pressure on Myanmar? I hope so. Someone needs to be accountable to this fact. But one other thing that needs to be stressed when it comes to this issue of oppression in Myanmar is one has to see that into the international community has got to help Myanmar establish a credible police force. Because when you have a credible police force, that will act in itself as a check against military force. Right. Military force, which is aligned with the government. Of course, police is part of government, but in terms of police must be used to maintain peace and stability. Where else, when military comes in already, it's already aggression by the state. And therefore, people in the international community needs to put more pressure as well as giving assistance to Myanmar in building up these institutions in the country.
We're speaking today to Ame Fari Rahim, Director of Strategy at KRA Group. We will be covering a bit more stuff, particularly about India as well as Palestine and Israel. You are listening to the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Bole for Malaysia. Ha. BFM 89.9, the business station.
It's the Evening Edition with Kelvin and Ayman, and we are looking at some of the international headlines of 2019. Joining us to do that is Ame Fari Rahim, Director of Strategy at KRA Group. Now, Islamic State leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi was killed in a military operation by the US. How will his death affect sleeper cells around the world and in Southeast Asia?
I think this is it's an achievement, of course, by the US and its allies in the death of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. But with the death of a major figure in these sort of organizations, the worry is it will give rise to 1,000 other terrorists who take the name, who wants to avenge the death of such figures. And this is why the focus should now be, yes, correctly, on the sleeper cells, not particularly in the Middle East, but in regions like ours in Southeast Asia. Because as you can see, radicalization happens through social media, right? And words from preachers and those who are supportive of terror acts, for instance, and those sort of narrative find their audience so easily in areas outside of where the actual event takes place. So Southeast Asia is a good example of that. And therefore, in terms of counterterrorism strategy, for Malaysia, we need to make sure that I think the police force is doing a very good job in getting intelligence and checking in and all these potential I don't know what's the correct word for it. But yeah, this potential fighters in terms of monitoring who is watching. Well, the big state, I'm sure, is monitoring who is watching what kind of video content and what kinds of like videos get passed around, especially in the Pondok schools, where you know, Islamic schools which are not registered with the government, for instance. And secondly, is making sure that Malaysia, as a we control the fact that Malaysia does act as a transit to the Middle East, Malaysia, and actually Indonesia. In this case, it acts as a transit hub.
There was a report saying that, right?
Yes, there has been, and I think the police force is monitoring it very, very closely, and they need to curb the role of Malaysia and Indonesia as the transit hub to Middle East for these so-called fighters.
Another event that happened this year is the special semi-autonomous status of Jammu and Kashmir, which was formally revoked by the Indian government in October. And this was supposedly to end militancy in the region. So what is the game at play here? Because this is obviously very controversial. So what is the game plan of India right here? And what will it mean for stability in the region?
Well, I see it's more political posturing than anything else. The re-election of Prime Minister Modi and the big wins by BJP across the national elections this year, much to the surprise of some people who've been watching India, because he has just gotten more nationalist, moving more to the right at a faster pace. Of course, people were surprised that the electorates were to reward him so handsomely. But I think this is again in the Jammu Kashmir context. It's a political posturing of to show now that he's won the elections, Hindutva ideology is there to stay, and we can expect that. No, this is more of muscling as well, showing signal, especially to Pakistan and Pakistan's backers, that hey, like, you know, this always has been a contentious issue, and now I want to show you that I'm confident with the election victory and people backing me on this, that we will state our claim as rightly so, enshrined in whatever their whatever rhetoric that they've been pushing, and will therefore continue to stake a very strong claim on Jammu and Kashmir, which is going to be a very contentious issue. And instead of trying to curb militancy, it could actually encourage greater threat of militancy and terrorist activities surrounding that area.
And also now moving our focus to Palestine and Israel, the Kushner Plan was proposed earlier this year, promoting peace through economic development incentives, allegedly. What's the situation right now in terms of the reception in Israel and Palestine towards the plan? And does it meet the expectations of both parties?
I don't know whose expectations that this plan actually meets. It's a very interesting plan by Jared Kushner, of course, the President Trump's son-in-law and senior advisor, of trying to promote economic activity amounting to about $50 billion to attract investments. Basically, I think this particular move, it is not accepted positively in Israel and Palestine on both sides. The Palestinian leadership has refused to entertain such plan. And at the end of the day, the Israel and Palestine issue has got to be settled politically. There's got to be a political decision. It's not an economic decision. What we are seeing Trump is trying to promote is the Trump administration. It's a very typical Trump way of trying to solve all these big, grand issues. And he thinks that by pursuing this type of strategy, trying to appease the Palestinians with economic package, while on the other hand trying to acknowledge the Israelis' claim to the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and most part of the land, and still trying to pursue a two-state solution, is the way forward. But if the Palestinians are not talking, there is very small chance of this deal moving through. And what more, the Israeli politics at the moment is in shambles. They are going for the third election in the space of 18 months. Netanyahu cannot get a majority, and therefore in March they will have to face off with another round of elections. And he is also facing tremendous number of charges of corruption against him and his family. Therefore, whether or not the Israelis will want to champion the solution is, I think it will only happen if Prime Minister Netanyahu sees this as the opportunity to boost his own standing in the elections. Then the Israeli elite will support this Trump peace plan in Israel-Palestine. But so far, there's so much pessimism over whether this peace deal will actually be accepted by any parties. One barometer is when Kushner himself announced the economic package and called for a summit in Bahrain. very low level of representation flew in to discuss. And again, this is not a real, it's not a real estate deal, which Kushner is known as a real estate man, right? And this isn't a real estate deal. It needs a real political solution before any economic solution can help the situation there.
We are speaking today to Ame Farid Rahim, Director of Strategy at KRA Group. After this, we will be looking at Brexit, the US, and also the protests happening all over the world. So stay tuned for that. You are listening to the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Break from monotony. BFM 89.9.
It's Kelvin and Ayman on the Evening Edition, and we are joined today by Ame Farid Rahim, Director of Strategy at KRA Group, helping us to look at and wrap up some of the international events of 2019. So Brexit, of course, was still a major theme this year. What does it say about the primacy of supranational organizations and the sovereignty of member states when you look at this situation?
Given the rise of nationalism in the second half of this decade, it makes you wonder whether supranational organization can last given that pressure of nationalism that is everywhere now. At the end of the day, supranational organization has got to give room for national interests of its member countries. And if it can't accommodate, then its longevity, I think, will be in great jeopardy.
And on that note, what can ASEAN learn then in terms of, you know, anticipating or meeting the needs of member states while at the same time strengthening relations within the association?
I think ASEAN, and I've spoken about this on many forums, that the beauty about ASEAN is as long as they are meeting, as long as they're shaking hands and taking that photo where they're holding each other's hand, wearing whatever the national costume of that particular country for a meeting, then that's good progress already. ASEAN should not be overly trying to impose like a uniform value system onto its member countries. It needs to just be a forum where they meet and talk and discuss issues with regards to the interests of all member countries, as well as individual and encouraging individual bilateral relation between the member countries. Because if you try to force lines and reinforce certain lines, ASEAN can break up. You have to remember that also ASEAN, in terms of geography, it's divided between the north and the archipelagic south, the northern peninsula, the CMLV, Cambodia, Myanmar, Laos, Vietnam, and also Thailand up north. They are more similar culturally. If you try to force this line and whereby you think that there should be greater ASEAN unity, there should be one system, conformity to this and that, there might be fear that the more you push for that, the more the ASEAN experiment will fail.
Now, let's take a look at the impeachment proceedings in the US. The response to them have largely been along party lines. Do you think the Democrats will be disappointed in the outcome of the impeachment hearings, considering it will be overseen by the Republican-dominated Senate?
Well, as we know, it is a two-part process. To bring it to this first part already, with two articles brought to the House, which brings about impeachment, I think the Democrats can pat themselves on the back and consider this a success. Of course, the Senate is controlled by the Republican, and when there is so the second part of the process is a trial in the Senate starting in January. Senate is controlled by the Republican, and you need two-thirds vote there in order to convict the president of impeachment, president of the wrongdoing and impeach the president. Of course, in a Republican-controlled Senate, that is going to be tough. Therefore, for the Democrats, they should be celebrating this win already. This is what they've wanted. And you have to remember that next year, in 2020, the Democrats will go for a long primary session to pick their presidential candidate. And this issue can help galvanize the Democrat crowd. But at the same time, given the longish runway, the trial starts in January, and some analysts are already predicting that it will wrap up, of course, definitely surely by the end of first quarter, if not earlier, that it will give enough runway for President Trump to repair his image. But having said that, the support that he's been receiving from the Republican Party, and especially also with this vote, the impeachment vote in the lower house, goes to show that the Republicans are still solidly behind President Trump. His approval ratings is still hovers around 40+%, and that's a fairly okay approval rating for an incumbent president going into an election year. Yeah, but it is also interesting, this whole impeachment process is the first for a president seeking re-election. Mm. And how this issue will be played out will be of utmost interest to American watchers, and of course the wider world.
And also this year, there have been several protests, and most notably the Hong Kong protests and the Gilets Jaunes, or the Yellow Jacket protests, which has, both of them have been going on for a long time, an extended period of time, despite the various responses from the heads of government. So why is this the case? Why do they keep continuing despite receiving some response from the target?
So if you look at these, as I said, it's been an angry decade, one. Two, if you look at both these protests in Hong Kong and in France, why I think, apart from the, it's a value-driven protest in Hong Kong, it's over the extradition bill, whereas in France, about the carbon tax and the wider reforms of Macron. But it's more of the response of the state that prolong the issue. In both cases, there are questions and allegations of police brutality. But at the same time, if you look at Hong Kong, this year's protest, I think, has been tremendously successful. It brought Hong Kong to a standstill. They learned the lessons from 2014. It's leaderless. It is anonymous. And thirdly, is that it is not afraid to embrace violence. This has caught a lot of people by surprise. Hong Kong has been badly impacted by the protests. And personally, for me, even, I haven't gone to Hong Kong for the past 3 months, because you just don't know whether you might be able to fly in, but to fly out, you might be delayed, right? Mm-hmm. So these are real concerns to investors. And of course, people who are watching how China would react to this. First, I think they underestimated the reaction to the extradition bill, one. Two, a lot of people in the first month of the protests had their bets that China would send in the military might across over to Hong Kong and stop the protests. But that did not happen. And then with the bashing of establishment candidates in the local elections in Hong Kong in November, it shows a very strong signal that the Hong Kongers are still not happy with Beijing. They're not happy with Beijing's way of handling the issue and intervening at every single decision that is taken by the local administration. How long will this last and how will it end? I think someone of high importance in the current administration in Hong Kong has got to step down. And that will, I think, start a process of re-engagement and renegotiation with the public. And certain institutions, especially the police force, which used to be touted as the best police force in Asia, yeah, but apparently that's now the only line that is used by Ms. Carrie Lam and not by the people anymore. People are they need to, moving forward, the Hong Kong administrators need to reinstill the confidence on the institutions that govern Hong Kong. in order for them to move forward and find not a closure but a settlement that is amiable for both sides.
And speaking of moving forward and looking forward, what do you think will be the issues of focus in 2020?
2020 is, of course, I think first, people would want to look at whether global growth will pick up. This past decade, we've avoided a global massive recession that comes every 10 years or so. Yeah. So have we deferred, managed to avoid one, or one is coming in 2020? That is always the question that a lot of economists are trying to figure out. Of course, there are predictions that global growth will slow down to about 3% next year. So it's interesting to see how will that impact Malaysia, for instance. We are a trading nation. And the eyes of the international world is on us with our chairmanship of APEC. How do we use this platform? What kind of issues will Malaysia champion as the host nation for APEC this year? Other than that, of course, in 2020, we're looking at the big presidential elections in the US.
Yes.
Okay, so I think everyone will just be following, of course, the Democratic primary, and the second half of the year would be the elections leading up to November. Whether Trump will be able to maintain his place in the White House, and will there be a challenger from the Democrat race that is refreshing? And of course, in terms of Brexit, will Boris Johnson get it done by December 2020? And with that big mandate that he just won, and now expectation is on him to deliver a Brexit that will be good enough for Britain. But I somehow feel that they will end up with a no deal, a no trade deal in place by December 2020. UK will just exit the European Union and will figure out from there how it wants to deal with the rest of the world.
Amir, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
For a tour around the world.
Yes.
That was Amir Farid Rahim, Strategy Director of Strategy at KRA Group. You've been listening to The Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my, BFM 89.9, the business station.